Welcome to the Artistic Foodies, the show that explores life through the lens of art and food. I'm Abbas Muhammad.
And I'm Irfan Raidan.
And today we're continuing our conversation with Wajahat Ali and Monisha Shiva from the Domestic Crusaders. We delve a little deeper to learn more about the people behind the story, as well as the importance of representation and storytelling. If you enjoy this episode, be sure to also catch the previous episode, a deep dive on the play itself, either on Spotify or wherever else you get your podcasts.
I also noticed on your IMDb that you've been in some good, some big films like The Guru, and then you were also in some TV shows, that most recently Hawkeye on Disney Plus, which is great. So tell us a little bit about your experience in working in these TV and films.
Yeah, so for Guru, it was more dancing, and this was pre-Domestic Crusaders, and for Hawkeye, I had a small role, a very small role, mother. Mm-hmm. But I hope those roles will get bigger. I just did a web series actually called Dyed in the Wool, and that's more, it's more independent, and it's mm-hmm. running through film series right now. I mean, sorry, film festivals right now.
Oh, nice.
And it's comedy. It's sort of like. I'm a lead character. There's two lead characters. So, and it's basically, it's very New York. It's based in New York, and I'm looking for a job, and I'm going to different friends to look for a job. And, mm-hmm. and it's just the reactions I get from the different pockets of friends that I go to. And it's just complete comedy. Yeah.
Nice. That's yeah. awesome. I just looked it up. Is this the one web series by Bill Soares?
Bill Soares, yeah. You can catch it on Instagram. Dyed in the Wool, yes.
Pretty cool. Well, you heard it. You heard it here, guys. Check it out. I'm definitely gonna check this out. This looks really interesting. So it's being released on Instagram. This is so like, this is so 2021.
Instagram series. So. That's cool.
Yeah, and also there's another. Another thing that's making festival rounds is mm-hmm. it was a play, but then we filmed it and released it as a film called News from Fukushima. And it deals with the Fukushima disaster. It's written by Yuri Kagayama. She's an AP journalist, and she covered the disaster when it happened in Japan. And so she combined all her journalism, her poetry, and made this into a play of sorts. And that's making festival rounds too right now.
As we know, maybe like 20 years ago when Domestic Crusaders first came out, there was not too many roles. But now we see a lot more Desi people, brown people on TV and movies. So how is that from your personal experience? Have you seen like a big growth and more opportunities as an actress or actor?
Yeah, I mean, my God, times have definitely changed from 10 years ago. There seems to be more opportunities. I mean, I'm definitely hearing about more auditions, mm-hmm. and I'm hearing about more roles. So times are changing. I just hope that we get to tell the stories that that help us curate the vision we want to see in the future, mm-hmm. not just regurgitate old stories, but really tell stories where you have an important vision for the future. I think that's quite important. It's one something mm-hmm. I learned from, well, the late bell hooks is what she used to touch upon quite a bit about the role of art. It's just mm-hmm. not, it's not just storytelling. It's also talking about the vision of the future, you know?
you know, we've talked a lot about the past and the present and the future, how things have changed, what hasn't changed. Would you say that the Domestic Crusaders is still relevant today? Is this something that people should be going out, picking up and reading and being able to find some sort of hope and solace and empowerment in today's age?
Yeah, absolutely. It's absolutely relevant today. Again, we deal with Islamophobia still. We still deal with also all the other brown folks, you know, dealing with racism as well. It's so relevant because our household is sort of many of they see how household is structured like what we see in the Domestic Crusaders.
Right.
You know, many of familial struggles you'll see still relevant as you will see in the play. Mm-hmm. So I think just by the political climate and also just the way family members relate to each other, I think it's completely relevant, you know. And it's such comedy to it too.
Like it feels natural. It feels genuine, you know.
It feels so genuine, yeah. Wajad did a really great job as being a muse for each of these characters.
Yeah.
Including the details.
You know, he influenced a lot of people to say, hey, it's okay to be a writer or to be a journalist. Or this is obviously pre 9/11, you know. You know, we grew up in the same area in the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. So typical of most Desi parents is, you know, they don't think about the arts is not even close to their mind at all.
Right.
And even something that's outside of the basic, you know, medicine or engineering is the two main ones, I'm sure. So even anything outside of that or computer science here in the Bay Area, which is another big one, then they think that you're crazy. Like one time, you know, I studied architecture myself, architectural design, and because I was into drawing a lot. And my father kind of said, hey, why don't you try architecture? Because he thought it was a good career choice. That's a different story. You have to listen to the first episode of our podcast to see the rest of the story. But, but basically, people used to say, oh, why are you doing this field? I used to tell people, like, because in the future, you're going to need someone to design your masjid or your house or your business building or whatever. And that's what happened is, like, you know, now the community has grown so much. And now people who know that I have some kind of connection to architecture, they always contact me. So I'm looking for an architect. I'm looking for an architect to do this, to look at this. And
oh, wow.
So it's like, you know, sometimes you have to kind of, you don't have a vision of the future, right? You're just thinking of what do I need to do right now? So, and that's the same with art, I think, is that our community didn't realize that art, writing, public speaking, you know, going and making TV and film is something that we need. Mm-hmm. For the future development of our community. And so now, you know, 20, 30 years later, that's starting to happen. So it's a good thing. But a lot of times our people don't see that need. They're just concerned about what I got to do right now to pay the bills and, you know, absolutely, make a good living.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's especially harder in this country since art is not, it's not like as supported as other countries might, you know, be, you know, maybe in Europe or so, but yeah.
And it's so critical. So, you know, thank you for doing the work that you're doing, and we hope to see you, you know, a lot more on the screen.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, it's so important. I mean, like you were saying in the beginning about politics, like, you know, are we going to bring politics into this? But like when you realize the reality of today's day and age, everything is politics. Your own existence can be resistance. You just doing what you do unapologetically is sometimes the greatest protest. of them all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just not taking no for an answer. So really appreciate and admire everything that you've done so far and excited for what's coming up ahead.
We continue our conversation with Wajahat Ali, who shares the importance of storytelling. He also paints a picture of the background of what was going on in his life when he first started writing The Domestic Crusaders and the aftermath of the events of September 11th.
Now, what happened? It's in April, like 6 months after I started, was my parents got arrested. And it became part of like this huge, I write about this in the book. It's a big, it just was insane. Like my next 12 years of my life were insane. So I'm sitting there in April, about to graduate. I got admitted to law school. Finals are coming up in May. And I get this phone call from my papo, Yasmin Papo, who's like, beta, you should probably come home because like 30 FBI agents came and like arrested your parents at fudger time. I'm like, what? And you have two daddies that you have to take care of because my two grandmothers were there. I'm an only child. So she goes, you got to take care of this. So overnight, I kind of leave school. I'm the only child. I'm like, okay. And I try to figure out what's happening. And then, you know, my parents, I could talk about this later. It's fine. But like my parents were in their pajamas sleeping in the old school uncle auntie pajamas. And 30 FBI agents with guns battered down the door. Jeez. Helicopter dragged them out of bed. My daddy, my grandmother was like, in her English, was like, what are you doing? And my parents had no idea. They're like, what's happening? Then they read this 30 plus count indictment. My dad almost fainted. And it was something called Operation Cyberstorm, which at that time, Microsoft and the FBI said it was the biggest piracy sting of all time. Robert Mueller even came. And so my parents, which was amazing, like the whole story is so amazing, I write about it, is that my parents weren't actually involved in this piracy sting that like netted 22 people, 24 people. A couple of those folks I know I feel really bad for. They got caught. A few of those people actually did this. They were in the same office complex of the people who did this. And even though they didn't have any piracy counts, they had a count with Microsoft for a business they did with them a couple of years ago on licensing and software. But it didn't matter. The story, this is how important a story is. The story is Fremont-Pakistani couple gets wrapped up in Operation Cyberstorm, the biggest anti-piracy sweep of all time. My parents were on the front page.
What a headline.
My parents were on the front page of the FBI website. And, people only read the – it's an indictment, a complaint, right? It's not – so people only read the headlines. And Microsoft alleged that as a result of this licensing thing that they said my parents got a license from them fraudulently and they sold software, that if that did not happen, maybe they could have potentially gotten $100 million. So instead of saying – Microsoft throws out this absurd $100 million number as damages. The headline and the mindset was Pakistani couple stole $100 million part of Operation Cybersting. So Irfan remembers this. Everyone thinks,
yeah. You're like, where was that money when I was there?
Exactly. So like, look, I was very open with my parents. I was like, if you guys did something, tell me, I need to know. And we did this thing with them a couple of years ago. And now they're saying $100 million. I'm like, if there's $100 million, I need it right now. I can really use it because I got to get a lawyer for you and this and that. So in our communities, I can't blame people. People are like, Haramzade Saleh Kutte, Benchot, that's why they had that's why they had those parties at their house. That's why they had the molids. That's why she dressed nice. You know what I'm saying? Just think about community politics. Right. Saleh had $100 million. Okay. But that's the story. That's the power of a story. And once a story like that spreads, just like the story of Islam and Muslims, just like the story of Rage Boy, right? Like anti-Muslim, it gets embedded in the psyche, right? And it's very hard to dislodge that story. So the reason why I mentioned this in with your simple question of how you wrote Domestic Crusaders is I left school. I left everything for like 2 years. I had to take care of my family as my parents were in jail. And then I had to get my parents out. And then we had to rebuild ourselves. And then about a year, my parents were in jail for a year almost because that's how long it took for me to raise the property and the money to get them out on bail. Because the judge heard all this and it was like $1 million bail. And I couldn't use my property because my property, according to the government, was now part of the criminal investigation. Okay? So like just everything, everything terrible. They're like, this was fraud and you did money laundering and the property that you bought was with the Microsoft money. So now that is subject to criminal forfeiture. And so I couldn't even use my own property as collateral. And you have to realize when a story like that is out there after 9/11, you guys remember how terrified our communities were after 9/11? We still are. It's like chilling effect. Lo kya bolenge, FBI se mat baat karo, don't talk to the FBI, don't go there. People were scared out of their mind. I remember this one uncle who's an attorney who used to be my father's friend. He said, beta, son, the reason why no one is coming to your help is everyone has skeletons in their own closet and everyone's terrified. And he was talking about taxes and immigration. Just think about it. Everyone's got something, right? Or not even that. They're just scared. So my parents were in jail for a year. And finally, I got like some people in some family to act as signatories and get the property. And they finally got out. Okay. They get out, halfway house. They come out. My mom had a freaking ankle monitor, like a Pakistani auntie. Can you believe this, right?
Oh, my God.
And like, you know, they finally start rebuilding their life. Take after about a year. Now, when this happens, I have been going nonstop fight or flight for a year. Lawyers, community, money, running the business, all this crap. So what happens when you're like when you exercise, right? And you stop exercising, what happens is your body kind of catches up. When the adrenaline's gone, what happens? You kind of collapse. So I collapsed in many ways because my parents came out. And I'm like, what do I do? I haven't even graduated. Like, what do I do with my life, right? And everything was falling apart. The house is gone. The money's gone. The reputation's gone. People treat us like we're herpes and kryptonite. you know, my health is gone. And the reason why I mention all this in relation to Domestic Crusaders is while everything was gone, the one thing that I had left, this sounds melodramatic, was my story.
Fremont Afghan Kebab has two locations in the San Francisco Bay Area, the original location in Fremont, as well as their newest location in Santa Clara. Both locations feature all of their most popular dishes, including bulani, chopan, which are lamb chops, qabali palau, beef and chicken kebabs, and of course, the classic chapli kebab. You can check them out online, on Yelp, on Google Reviews, or on their website at FremontAfghanKebab.com.
So I want to quickly talk a little bit about your journey through to mainstream media. Like obviously after the play, then you got a little bit more well-known. You continued writing for major publications, you know, like New York Times and other publications. And then you got a job on CNN. So how was that, you know, what was that journey like? And, you know, I know a lot of people were happy to see a Pakistani Muslim person on CNN. So that was, I know a lot of people in the community like that. And so how was that journey for you?
I decided to write what I wanted to write, how I wanted to write. And then, inshallah, if I wrote well, the people who would want to work with me would come to me. That was my strategy. I had graduated. So the play, we premiered it. I thought, okay, things will open up. Nothing opened up. I'm 25 now. I'm in law school. My parents are still out of jail. They have appealed the case. There's still a sword hanging down on our neck because if they lose the appeal, they go to jail, right? So that was my life throughout my 20s. I was stuck, 1 foot stuck in concrete, one foot like reaching for the stars. And at any moment, my parents could have lost their appeal and been whisked to jail. And I'd have to come back and clean up the crap. That was my entire 20s, up to the age of like 31. Okay? So the play is a success. Locally, nothing takes off nationally because I have these absurd conversations with producers who are like, you know, we really love the play, but you need to make it more mainstream. You should make Ted Danson be the father. And I'm like, what? Salman, the Pakistani father? He goes, yeah, Ted Danson can play the role. People like Ted Danson. And I was like a boss. I laughed and the guy wasn't laughing. No I'm way. Like, this is crazy. So I graduate law school and I graduate law school like in 2007. And I'm like, maybe, finally 6 years after this chaos of my parents and poverty, maybe inshallah I can remake my life. Finally, now is the time. And my parents are still on appealing their case to get. Great recession happens. I end up back in my home, getting my mom tomato and mirch for biryani, completely broke. And every day I wake up and I find $5 in my wallet. And my father said, beta, no man should do that. and like, I'm sitting there and on Monster and Craigslist, like just hours a day cranking out resumes, like for 6 months. My professors like me. They're like, this is really weird. You should have gotten a job. I get interviews. It's like, it's just wild. Like, I can't get anything. And I'm like, what's wrong? What's happening? Like, why? I felt like it was almost like a curse, right? So I'm going boggle at home. And I decide, because I was going stir crazy, because you, like, you can't just sit there all day and just freaking do resumes, right? I decided to write a piece. This was 2007. And, you know, Blackwater and Iraq and private military firms were in the news. This is a deep cut for those of you guys who remember. And I'm like, oh, in law school, I wrote a paper on this. So I transformed that paper into an essay, like a 3-page essay. Ticket. I got it submitted on Counterpunch. They published it and they said, this is really good. You can send us anything you want. And so within 6 months, I wrote so much and I interviewed so many people that people started calling me a social media journalist. And I got invited to Berkeley to teach other journalists about social media. This was a time where people were like, what? The blog? What is the Facebook? And so the hilarious thing was, I'm like, wait, I'm a social media journalist? And like, you are. I'm like, I am. Yes. And they're like, would you like an honorarium? I'm like, what's that? I'm like, your fee. What's your fee? I'm like, how much are you offering? And they're like, $500. I'm like, yes. So literally, I fell into it. But the kind of mindset that I had was, I'm stuck. I'm broke. No one's paying me. So I will write what I want to write, how I want to write, and I'll write prolifically and I'll do quality work at a prolific rate. I'll outwork everyone. And inshallah, somehow the right people will come to me, right? And I will do all these things I want to do, the play, law, writing. And eventually all these streams will converge into a powerful current. And if I'm alive, that'll make my career. So, you know, I'm 27 now. I'm about to turn 28, and like any young man, I think I'm going to die by the age of 30. And I think, you know, I'm like premature midlife crisis. And I'm like, I've done nothing with my life. And so plus my parents might go to jail. So I had this accelerated clock that most people don't have, that I thought my life would end in many ways, literally and figuratively, by 30, 31, 32. I didn't see beyond 35. I thought I would die, which just sounds crazy, but I thought, like, I just had this feeling I would die. Like my heart would give up or something would happen. I talk about it in the book. So I'm like, I have to do everything now. And I've lost everything. The checklist has blown up. I don't care because I already see him as a criminal. And in a strange way, I can tell you this, is that the failure gave me a liberation. Does that make sense? Because if all this crap didn't happen, I would have gone. Everything was gone. Yeah, I'm the son of criminals. I'm broke. My house is foreclosed. Like, you know, what do they expect? Nothing. And had I gone the traditional route, I guarantee you I would have started my career now at the age of 41, because I would have married the wrong girl. I would have gotten divorced. I would have gone to corporate law, made money. I would have gone to probably my friend who's a therapist at Stanford, like just eating anxiety pills. I'm just telling you straight up. Like I would have followed the checklist to my own unhappiness. Does that make sense? And so the Pakistani Desi checklist, the Bay Area checklist, Lokya Bolenga, upper middle class, American dream. And all my friends who are therapists in the Bay Area say all my clients are upper class, upper middle class, successful people who are absolutely miserable with their life and exhausted. You guys know this. So in a strange way, in hindsight, this path forced me to do something I always wanted to do. I started writing. People started liking the writing. One thing led to another. Then I got into the Huffington Post. Then I got into the Guardian. Then I decided to do the play because this country decided to elect a Muslim president, Barack Obama. So I'm like, maybe we can finally do the play in New York. So did the play in New York, 2009. Got more and more opportunities to write. Now I was doing law during the day to pay my bills. So I was like a solo attorney. And I was like the Rainmaker. If you ever seen that Rainmaker John Grisham novel, which turned into a movie with Matt Damon, it's hilarious. Like this really bright law student who graduates. And he's also like poor and he can't find a job. So then he does like all these menial tasks. And my father, I remember, was watching this movie and he goes, Beta, that's you. And I'm like, I don't know if this is a compliment or not. And so that's how I merged everything together. And at the age of 30, I'm like, okay, I'm about to turn 30. I'm holding the copy of my play that just came out. HBO has now reached out to me and Dave Eggers. Based off our pitch to this cop show, I'm getting a little bit of money there to keep myself alive. Some people are knowing me as a writer. And then my parents get arrested again because they lose their case. And overnight, right when I'm about to go supernova, my parents get finally arrested. And then when this time they get arrested because they lose the appeal, they go to jail for 4 years. And this time in our community, the Bay Area, where everyone was so cruel, in a way people felt like really like pity. Because they're like, what? We thought they'd like gone over the case. It was still going on? What? Damn. And so the house now is foreclosed. I'm homeless overnight, right? Like, Ami, they give my mom 6 months to report because Ami had to, you know, they said, they arrested my father immediately and they're like, we'll give you 6 months to take care of everything. So I'm helping my mom now take care of everything. And all the money I had now is gone. The law fees, the house is gone. So we're homeless. We sell everything for the pennies. I end up driving my mother to the prison, like, which is a hella weird experience. You know, I write about it in the book. And so while this is happening, And so, and, you know, everyone thought I was a success at this time, which is hilarious. They're like, wow, you're killing it. And I'm like, no, I'm homeless. And every time I used to say that, people are like, ha, 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 Wajahat. You're so self-deprecating. And I'm like, what? This, I felt like I was in a Twilight Zone because everyone thought I was crushing it and I was crushed. And no one would believe me, which is like, can you imagine living a life like that where you're like, I'm homeless and people are like, ha, 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 you're killing it. I'm like, okay. So it was a very intense, absurd period. And the way I got to TV was based upon the play and the Fear Inc. think tank report that I did and these small things I kept doing just to survive, just to keep alive. They started adding up. And at 31, while my parents were in jail, I had a near-death experience. Right. So that's when I had the near-death experience in where I was like, they had to cardiovert me 3 times at Washington Hospital on Fremont Boulevard. Cardioversion is like 3-2-1 clear. You see that in the movies. It's because my heart rate went to 230. I had this thing called supraventricular tachycardia. I had a freakish near fatal episode that is very rare. My heart rate went to 230 and stayed at 230. So then I had congestive heart failure. And then I was like drowning in my own like fluids. And then they had to cardiovert me 3 times. And like, it was bad. Like, it was bad. So I had the whole near-death experience. I had my negotiation with God. You know, I write about it in the book. And I'm like, you know, they all thought I was going to die. I thought I was going to die. So I made peace with, you know, dying. And then my one regret was, I'm like, man, I should have gotten married. I should have had a family. I'm going to die by myself. That was my only regret. Other than that, I said, you know, Allah, you gave me a good life. I can't complain. And I swear to you, when I had that one, like, thought, my heart rate stabilized finally. Like really near the end, like I was about to go. And so with that realization, that's what made me this decision that I talk about in the book is to like get married. I kind of quasi eloped with my wife while my parents were in jail. And I moved to DC. And when I moved to DC for my wife, I was completely broke. I had a 97 Camry without a driver's side door handle. I had a couple of comic books. And I had a PS3. That's all I had. And my wife,
PS3 is crucial. She married me.
Yeah, crucial. That's just the crucial stuff. And I remember Al Jazeera America at that time said, hey, we heard a rumor that you moved to DC. You were actually on the stream to promote your play, and we really liked you. We're starting a new network called Al Jazeera America, and we're doing the stream for that. And we know you've never done TV, but we've read your articles and seen you on social media. We think you actually might be a really good co-host. You want to come and audition? And I'm like, I'm really busy building IKEA furniture for my wife, and they all laugh, but I was dead serious. And I'm like, oh, you think I'm actually like serious? So I went and auditioned, and then I remember a couple months later, boom, that's how I got on TV. Like I literally fell on TV. Like 6 months later, I'm live on television hosting. And you know, Al Jazeera America failed, but while I was doing that, I kept doing more speeches that helped me with my profile. It gave me training on TV. I was terrible at first. You know, because I had developed this amazing relationship with editors over the past few years, they knew me to write well and write fast. Some of those editors then went to New York Times. And one of those editors that worked in New York Times said, yo, I'm at New York Times now. It's kind of impossible to get in here. It's all crazy. No one knows what works, but keep pitching me. So I pitched up 2 pieces and they rejected it. And for a third piece, well, this was like 2015. I'm like, you know, let me just do like a very funny parody. And he's like, this is hilarious. They're never going to publish it. And that's the one they published. And when they published that, he says, listen, I'm going to actually lend you off to an editor here who shares your sensibilities. And then we hit it off. And then Trump started running and Trump ran on the Muslim ban. Mm-hmm. And so that gave me an entrance to write about politics from the Muslim perspective. God forbid if I just write about politics as an American. Can't do that. So, you know, so I'm like, all right, Haramzadeh, I know how this game is played. I'll Trojan horse it and I'll do the ethnic stuff to talk about mainstream stuff. You see what I'm saying? And so that's how I started writing with New York Times. That's how they started bringing me on TV. And when they brought me on TV, I remember they used to first say, and now Muslim journalist. What the hell is a Muslim journalist? Like it was, and then finally there was people on social media. They're like, what's a Muslim journalist? And I remember they used to ask me, like, as a Muslim, what do you think about Donald Trump, you know, tapping Jeff Sessions as attorney general? So around 2016, 2015, you know, if on television, if you're good TV, they like you. Good TV means you're prepared. You get along well with the producers and the host. You can talk in a pithy sound bites. You can be punchy and people like seeing you. I came in prepared like a good Desi kid. What I didn't realize is a lot of people are sloppy and they bring in notes. I was like a dork. I thought, what? I remember when I was at the round table, my first round table, 2016 inauguration, when Trump was inaugurated, they did this huge panel on DC. I was only supposed to come on for one segment.
But CNN.
So they just kept me on for the next 2 hours. Mm. Yeah, for CNN. I wasn't official. This is when they like auditioned you, I guess. And so everyone has, as a guest, everyone has like these notes. I'm like, you can bring notes? Yes. I mean, because, you know, people are bringing notes and they're like, yeah, they're tablets. And I'm like, what? And like a Desi kid, I just did the research.
Yeah.
Right? I came in prepared. And so I came in prepared. I was fast. I knew my stuff. I had the facts and I was good TV. And I remember I kept doing it back and forth, back and forth. And finally, you know, I did it for free. And my wife is like, we have two kids. You can't keep going to New York for doing this for you. This is enough. So I made the decision. I'm like, this is my last month. I went and talked to CNN and they're like, listen, we like you, but this is a very coveted position and not everyone gets it. Keep trying. I'm like, okay, whatever. I left. If you guys remember 3 years ago, in Christchurch, there was a terrorist who killed 50 Muslims.
Yeah.
You guys remember that? I was up late at night. This had happened. So this was Thursday night, Friday morning for us. In New Zealand had already happened. I was waiting for just enough evidence because having spent so many years researching these domestic terrorists and Islamophobia, I saw all the connections immediately. Does that make sense? It's like that Rain Man moment. You like see all the cards. And once I got enough data, I did a 10-tweet thread about Islamophobia, anti-Semitism, the conspiracy theories, how it gets mainstreamed, how it radicalizes people. Boom, 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 boom. I did the 10-tweet thread. It went viral. I slept. I got this phone call at 6 a.m. from like Jim Sciutto from CNN. He goes, come on my show in 2 hours. I'm like, fine, man. They gave me 5 minutes where I just broke that ish down. And Jim Sciutto afterwards runs out and he goes, man, that was awesome. You made me look like a boss. I'm like, why? Because at our morning call, my boss, Zucker, who runs CNN, who was the president of CNN, he said, look at this Twitter thread by this guy, you know, probably Warbalak Ali. get this guy on TV. And Jim Sciutto was like, I have him booked. And so for the next 3 days, MSNBC, CNN, MSNBC, CNN, NPR, right? Crushed it. And on Monday, the same lady from CNN who 2 weeks ago said, oh, no, we don't have a position, texted me 6 times. We want you. We want you. Sign up with us. And so that's how I got on CNN. Wow.
That's pretty crazy.
You asked me a very simple question, but the reason I spent time on that is because for your listeners is people only see the success. Mm-hmm. And you know, we have the doubts, the struggles, the conspiracy theories. They're like, oh, everyone who makes it has to be a sellout. No, you have no idea, man. Like the fact that people like Riz and Hassan, I know them. You have no idea how hard it is for them to succeed being, number one, just talent, regardless of your ethnicity or gender. Number two, being brown Muslim talent. And number three, being brown Muslim talent who succeeded by not indulging in those narratives. Do you see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And you have to kind of see the warts and the pain and the ugliness to kind of appreciate the success. Otherwise, I don't really care about the success story because then people say, oh, Wajahat, mashallah, you're on New York Times and CNN. That's amazing. I wish I could do that. Who am I? I'm nobody. And I'm like, some of my favorite people are nobody. In fact, I'm a nobody. I'm a nobody from Fremont, California, who started off at Mehran Pakistani Indian restaurant. And I think that's why that story is important.
So we know that, or I have seen a lot of your Instagram posts about you cooking at home and making these nice Hyderabadi recipes that you got from your mom. You know, for your family and friends in DC.
So tell us a little bit about that, about how you kind of got into cooking and, you know, what inspired you for that and how's that going? Is it actually good?
So to answer the last question first, apparently it's very tasty according to the people who have eaten it. And nice, so that's nice. Good. And I entered a dal competition, the Dal
Olympics.
I got into it during pandemic because we couldn't eat out, right? And we have an immunosuppressed daughter. So mm-hmm. I was like, I'll finally learn how to cook. So on the phone for the first three or four times, Ami was there and FaceTime to look at the shakal, the face of the stuff. Because like moms are useless when I'm like, oh, how much like hari mirch should I put? And how much like turmeric should I put in? How much coriander should I put in? She's like, tortasa, andaza se.
Andaza se.
The F is tortasa, andaza se. And from your gut. I'm like, what? There's no measurement. Just tell me, woman. She goes, nee, main nahi bata sakti. Andaza se daal do, you're okay. Ungli batao, show me your fingers.
Sprinkle it on.
So, So we did that a couple of times. It turned out good. Then I learned like a few repertoire. I learned two dals, khatti dal, heather, meaty dal, khima, sag. And then I'm like, I started doing those. And then I'm like, let me get a little bit more ambitious. So then I did mirch ka salan. Then I did friggin' halim, oh, dude. Wow. I did halim.
That's impressive.
I did nahari.
That's a big deal.
And then so I gave halim to Mehdi Hassan, you guys know him. And Mehdi said, dude, this is restaurant quality halim. And his wife is a very good cook. So it's one of those things where you keep like challenging yourself and you become like, it starts off slow. Like for anyone who's trying to learn how to cook, I was always intimidated. So at first you get freaked out. Then you don't know what to use. Mm-hmm. Then you're terrified. It takes a long time. But you keep doing it like anything, it becomes a skill and you get the quote unquote andaza. Yeah. And so I'll give you an example now. Like just last week, I just happened to go to the butcher who was next to the grocery store. He gave me fresh khima, fresh ground beef, like fresh. It looks beautiful. He just like killed the goat and like just like
so in the blender, right?
Yeah. He goes, look. And he's like, you know how butchers get really excited? He's like, look, so fresh. And I'm like, so I took it home and I'm like, instead of putting it in the freezer, yo, I got to make this. So I had 30 minutes because, you know, you're at home, kids, you know how it is. So I cranked out this amazing khima in 30 minutes where I made kind of my own recipe. Blending together some recipes, but I cranked it out. I made that in an amazing meaty dal and chawal, 30 minutes.
And
it gives you like a sense of accomplishment. And I think for men, we like it because like it's all, especially Muslim men, like we have nothing else. I can't drink. I don't do drugs. I can't beat people up. I don't gamble. You know, I don't go to strip clubs. I'm married to a woman, happily married. I have nothing else. Like this is literally, and I eat halal. Zabiha. So there's literally nothing else. So, you know, that's why I kind of enjoyed it and I've indulged in it. And I keep trying to like push myself and you find new recipes and then you realize, oh, like it's a skill. If you spend time on it, you can do it. And then my wife really likes it. And if when your wife likes it and you cook it for your family and they really like it, like it makes you happy, right? Like that's why you understand like why ammis are the way they are. And I think ammis kind of taste better because they put love in it. That's like the secret ingredient. Yeah. And that is true though. Putting love into, and to be really serious, when you do it with love, what why does it taste better? Because you care. Yeah. You care more. And it shows, right? You spend the extra time, you make sure it's tasty, you don't half-ass it. And so that's why I think when our loved ones make us kinda, it just like brings us that warm feeling because you can taste the love.
It's our love language, and it's also how you say I'm sorry. Cause they say like we have too much pride to go up to anyone and say, hey, I'm sorry, but we can say, ikhalo.
It goes, someone said that you were upset that I punched you in the face and said your wife was ugly. Someone said that, but anyway, here's a,
hey, some, for Nahari.
And then the person eats Nahari goes, Nahari was good. You owe me halim for my child. My wife is taken care of, but you owe me halim for the child.
So you have a small recipe you can share and we can...
So what I do, okay, so with khima, what I do is the Hyderabadi khima is you don't use tomato, you don't use tomato, but you use methi, which is fenugreek. And for other people, you often use tomato. So what I do now is I did this like last week. It just turned out really good. I did like a small onion. I fried it, caramelized it. As you're caramelizing the small onion, right? You like this. Most desi like recipes are very similar. So you caramelize the onions. As you caramelize the onions, you add fresh ginger and garlic. You want to make sure you cook it, the raw stuff. So I want like one healthy teaspoon of ginger garlic paste. So now you can hear it crackle. Okay? What I do is I take a little bit of chili pepper, serrano pepper, it depends on your taste, mince it, and then I fry it with the piaz, the onion, okay? Then I do just to give it some, like a little bit, like, you know, of some flavor, but a little bit of salt and a little bit of garam masala, not too much, just to get the onion going, right? And now I put, I think it was like one or two small tomatoes, diced it up, and now I'm cooking the tomatoes with the piaz, okay? And now I'm trying to make it a little bit saucy. Mm. So I put a little bit of water, you make it a little saucy, cook. Then I put the khima, the fresh khima, like a pound of fresh khima. You mix it up. Then I put 1 teaspoon salt, a little bit of turmeric, a half a teaspoon or 1 teaspoon of red mirch. What do you call red mirch? Red chili pepper. Mm-hmm, okay, mm-hmm. Up to your taste. I put half a teaspoon of pepper. You don't have to, but I like it. Half a teaspoon of pepper. I put 1 teaspoon of garam masala. Okay, 2 teaspoons of this fenugreek, where you get this, the mm-hmm. fenugreek, you could get in like a box, right? The fenugreek, it gives a nice methi.
Oh, yeah, methi. I love methi. It's an herb.
Methi. Oh, okay. Yeah, herb. The Heather Wiley's use it, but it gives it a really good kick. So I put like these 2 teaspoons of methi, and then to treat yourself, put a half or 1 teaspoon of ghee mm-hmm. in it. All right. Now, how saucy you want it, it's up to you. And then you cook it and you put, you know, again, the sauciness or the less sauciness is up to you in the water. You cook that together, man. I'm telling you, you're going to have a sexy time khima.
Yeah. So tell us really, really quickly the name of your new book where people can
go back to where you came from and other recommendations on how to become American coming out January 25th. It's getting really good reviews. The people who have read it have really liked it. I'm very lucky and grateful for it. I think you'll enjoy it. If you're in the Bay Area, you will recognize a lot of our stories.
Great. Thank you so much for tuning in to the Artistic Foodies. Before we go, please do show some love for your favorite podcast by leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts.
Be sure to find us on Facebook and Instagram to stay tuned for more episodes as well as bonus content. You can also have access to all of our episodes at theartisticfoodies.com.
This podcast has been brought to you by Halal Fest Incorporated and Gamma, gathering all Muslim artists. Until next time.